This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
Hello and welcome to the Motor Mouth podcast with Harry Benjamin and Tim Sylvie. This is the place where we meet some of the biggest names in and around motorsport, chat about their lives and everything in between. This week we're joined by a Formula One veteran, starting off life as a journalist before being persuaded by Ron Dennis to lead the comms team at the McLaren F1 team. He's worked with the likes of Fernando Alonso, Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton, experienced the ups and downs of championship wins and Spygate. Matt Bishop joins us to discuss his career to date, his new ventures with the W Series, and how he's turned his hand to writing and is now a published author. Thank you so much to you guys who continue to download and listen. If you like it, please do leave us a review. It really helps us to get bigger. Enjoy.
Welcome to the latest episode of our Gearing Up series. And before I introduce today's guest, I need to head to Essex. And did you know that the famous English county is home to the second largest village green in the UK? Great Bentley's Green covers an incredible 43 acres and in Edwardian times was even used as a golf course, and these days is used for village events and even a nicely topical motorcycle rally. However, we're not here to bring your attention to Essex. We're here to interview another interesting personality from the world of motorsport. And to do that, I need to bring in my teammate, ally, collaborator, and indeed friend, Harry Benjamin. How are you?
Thank you, Tim. I'm very well. It's quite an Edwardian area, actually, Essex, I think I've worked out. All the houses are quite Edwardian. I'm not surprised by that fact. But yet again, you've done a stellar job with yet another ridiculous fact.
I know.
Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I am well. To ruin the illusion for listeners, this is the second one of today. So
yes.
How are you? Kind of seems a little bit...
yeah. Well,
how have you been?
I have changed my how am I status since an hour ago when we had our last podcast, because it was cooler then. It was still quite early in the morning and it was bearable in my shed. Now it's really hot. So I'm sweating considerably. So I apologize. If we do put this out on video, I apologize in advance to anyone watching this and seeing my disgusting red, sweaty British
lovely.
Face.
But
there we are. Enough of our rambling. Shall we bring in today's guest?
Absolutely, let's do it.
So I'm delighted to introduce you to a man you might well be familiar with from his extensive CV, which includes the likes of the W Series, the McLaren F1 team, Car Magazine, F1 Racing Magazine, and more. He's also a writer and has recently come out with a novel, which we'll touch on later. He's also actively involved in supporting LGBTQ+, inclusion, diversity, and discussion in motorsport. It's a great pleasure to welcome Matt Bishop to the Motormouth podcast.
Hello.
Hi, Matt. Thank you so much for joining us. Round of applause as ever. How's life been, first of all? 2020, absolute madness. All interviews have suddenly become via Zoom. Motorsport came to a stop. How have you navigated it all?
Yeah, we're all Zoom experts now, aren't we? 2020 is a year we'll never forget. Motorsport point of view, you know, obviously my main focus, my day job, is communications director of W Series. W Series very sadly had to take a sabbatical this year. I know other motorsport obviously has got going again, but we thought very carefully about it and decided, as not only a startup, but as an international startup with drivers that we have to ferry about not only Europe, but also Brazil, South Africa, United States, America, Japan, and so on, Russia. The logistic challenge of getting our drivers to our cars, to the circuits we might be able to race in, was just impossible, particularly as one of the pillars of W Series is not only, of course, that the drivers must all be women, but also that we will charge them not a penny piece for racing, which includes, by the way, all their travel, all their accommodation. So it actually became very difficult. Anyway, we did have the W Series Esports League, 30 races, sim races across 10 circuits involving all our drivers, working with Beyond Entertainment and iRacing and so on and so forth, streamed on the BBC. And that was, I think, very effective. This again, of course, this is the COVID-19 year, but it's also the year, from our rather smaller perspective, that sim racing exploded.
Yes.
And I think was in the vanguard of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're huge fans of the W Series, and we attended the one of the races last year at Brands, and we're hugely impressed by it, and seeing, you know, the mobs of small young girls you know, running up to the likes of Jamie and others, it warms the heart, and it's great to see women's motorsport finally coming to the fore. And we'll talk more about that later. One thing we want to touch on with you is we always like to get under the skin of our guests and find out where they've come from and where's home and all that sort of stuff. So take us back a few years, and where was home when you were growing up? What was it like, and were there any indications at that stage of what was to come for your career?
Well, you kicked off by talking about the Edwardian age. I'm not quite that old, but I was born in 1962, so in London. Which fair city I have lived in every day of my life since. Obviously, I've travelled extensively for work and holidays, but I've never lived anywhere other than London. I was brought up in a normal home in a part of London that wasn't then very well-to-do, but is now, Islington.
Yep.
There's pictures of me playing football in the street as a kid, with not a single car to be seen. Wow. On a road now, which if you walk down it, you'd find double parked Porsches. So, you know, life has changed. Anyway, for some reason, and I don't know why, because my mother was a novelist and my father was a classical concert pianist, he disappeared. Well, when I say disappeared, he left my mother quite soon. I'm still very much in touch with him, but he left my mother. And wasn't therefore so much a part of my upbringing as my mother was. I was brought up by my mother. But neither my father nor my mother, I don't think, had actually even heard of Formula One. I genuinely think they wouldn't have heard of it. They would have not known what it meant. They would have thought it was a chemical formula or perhaps a cocktail. They had absolutely no idea. And yet, springing out of I don't know where, came an obsession with cars in the first instance. So I would walk down the street or even be pushed in a chair down the street, and I would, little nerd that I was, identify all the cars, long lost brands, Morris Oxford, Austin Cambridge, Wolseley Hornet, Riley Elf, et cetera, Humber Super Snipe, and so on. I'd just call them out. And my mum thought, I think she just thought I was a little weird, really. And then, because you have to remember that Formula One wasn't even on television in those days. Formula One wasn't on television on a regular basis in the UK until the late 70s. On a regular basis, occasional races, usually the British Grand Prix and Monaco, appeared before. But in the you know, late 60s, when I was a nipper, not on the television, not on the radio, not in the newspapers, other than in 4 Point at the back in the posh newspapers like the Times and the Telegraph, along with the Croquet and the Bowls. And even then, it would just say, first, Jackie Stewart, second, Jochen Rindt, etc. And it wouldn't say who was fourth, fifth, and sixth. And it wouldn't say that somebody had led the first 30 laps until their engine had blown. So you have to remember it was a complete minority sport, but I spotted a magazine called Autosport in a newsagent in 1972. And I'd never seen a car like that, because it wasn't a Wolsey Hornet and it wasn't a Riley Elf. In fact, it was Jackie Stewart's Tyrrell. And I was mesmerised. And I bought it as a kid. I was 9 years old and probably 9 towards 10. And I read it from cover to cover.
How nice to have that that sort of level of clarity at that age, to know you see that car, you're like, that's it. That's what I need to be involved with. And such a nice position to be in, to think, that's it, I've found my calling. I'm done.
It was an epiphany. I can tell you, it was an epiphany. I thought, that is the business.
Amazing.
When did the moment click, though, or was that the moment when you were like, well, I want to be a journalist, I want to write about this as well? Because the fascination was there, but was also the idea of being a journalist and writing about this and communicating the sport, was that there at the same time?
I remember I was 9. What I would have was race the cars.
Yeah. Yes. Are you a frustrated racing driver? Is that what it is?
Half of the media centres of all sports events are populated by frustrated players and drivers and so on. In fact, it's one of the things, you will come to this later, when I worked with the likes of Lewis Hamilton and Jenson Button and Fernando Alonso, one of the things I used to say when I was trying to persuade them to do something like be interviewed or appear for a sponsor and they were being truculent about it, I used to say, listen, Lewis, listen, you're one of the lucky ones. You're quick. I wasn't quick. I was absolute crap. And that's why I've got to do this damn fool, stupid job. And you can go flat through Eau Rouge. So will you please go down and see Vodafone now?
Yes, yes, I will, Bat. Yes.
Brilliant. I'm sure we will touch on your days there in a little bit. So that's really, but yeah, as Tim said, to have that clarity is so nice. And obviously when you're 9 years old, I suppose that is the dream, to go fast, going round and round. So well then, in that case, when did the moment come then for you to be like, actually, okay, I think there's a career here that I would like to pursue? And then how did you start to go about that?
Well, I was a clever boy at school, but not an industrious one, and therefore didn't do particularly well. I did well in O-levels, which is, you know, what you call GCSEs now, but underperformed significantly I sound like Ron Dennis saying that. significantly. Anyway, messed up my A-levels, I think we could, to use normal non-Ron-speak English. And it's very catchy in Ron-speak.
I bet, yeah.
Oh, terrible. Anyway, I messed up my A-levels, didn't go to university, and instead went and worked in a factory, Unigate. That was quite handy because I could tell people I was at uni. But anyway, I then did various other odd jobs, and one of them was being a betting shop manager. And also moonlighting in the evenings at London Greyhound tracks, which are, I think, all closed now. White City, Wimbledon, Wembley, Romford, Hackney, Haringey, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. They're mostly Sainsbury's now. Anyway, Wembley was fun because it was actually at the then, you know, fantastic football stadium, you know, that all the FA Cup finals and the 1966 World Cup final were played in and so on. And the dogs ran round the track that was laid out around the edges of the pitch. So you went to this extraordinary, huge stadium with a couple of hundred dog fans have to make sure I don't say dogging. We used to call it dogging.
That's something different. Don't make that mistake. Yeah.
I think we've just got the, we've got the teaser now. We've got the podcast teaser now. Yeah. So I'll clip that up. Lovely.
Yes. We used to go dogging.
Warning, there will be greyhound racing discussed, oddly, and dogging, but not in that way.
Not in that way.
Anyway. Anyway, so you'd be rattling around in this extraordinarily wonderful stadium, and I used to work there as well, with some of the rails or the actual bookies down by the rails. Man, John Bauer, legend actually now, but nobody will have heard of him, of course, but he was a legend in that rarefied and small world at that time. Anyway, I got to know a man called Jim Kremin, who was, talk about a niche, he was Greyhound editor of the Racing Post. And he said to me, you express yourself. You've got the gift of the gab. You could write something. Why don't you write me a couple of little columns about something to do with Greyhound racing? So I did. And they were reasonably well received. And I mean, it's an astonishing way into my career when you think about it, isn't it? But what happened is that life was easier then. Life was easier in terms of getting employment. And remember, there were gazillions of newspapers and magazines because there were absolutely no websites. So, it was just a busy field with lots of opportunity. Not necessarily big money, but lots of opportunity. Anyway, I ended up, I've always been a careful technical writer, and I realised I had that natural ability or fussiness, going back to the nerdiness. And I became a sub-editor, first of all, France, and then I got my first actual media job, which was sub-editor of Car Magazine. So I'd moved away from Greyhounds and into automotive journalism via an unusual route. But then I became the features editor of Car Magazine, working with legends such as LJK Setright, who very few people watching this will have heard unless they're my age, Edwardian. But I was away. Then I was away. And I was writing about cars and writing about motorsport. And I had found my calling.
You very much changed the way motorsport reporting was done in the written word. You had a new way of reporting it, using different language, different way of talking about the sport, even different imagery. Take us through some of that and how you've seen the landscape change over the years.
Well, I was very lucky. From Car Magazine, I was then headhunted by Haymarket in 1996 to become editor of F1 Racing, which was a new magazine and the first big mainstream English language Formula One magazine since GPI, Grand Prix International, which had been a feature of the early 80s but had ceased to exist. And I arrived at a time when we had some fantastic narratives. We had Damon Hill versus Michael Schumacher. We had Bernie Ecclestone and Max Mosley, extraordinary, almost pantomime villains running the sport. We had all sorts of other great characters, Frank Williams, Ron Dennis, Eddie Jordan, all of these people. And then quite soon, we were hit with a problem, which was that Michael Schumacher and Ferrari started winning absolutely everything. We enjoyed the Hill era and the Häkkinen era, but then we got into the Ferrari winning everything era. And it's the elephant in the room, which is the same elephant that's in today's room, is that the same person winning all the time, however brilliant he is and however brilliant his team is, does rob the sport of an important ingredient that makes compelling all sport, which is suspense.
Yeah.
And there wasn't any then. And there isn't enough now. We might talk about that later as well. But what we realized is that the sport about which our magazine was devoted was itself not delivering in terms of entertainment, so we had to find different ways to actually, this sounds arrogant and it isn't meant to be, but to make our magazine more interesting than the sport itself.
Yeah.
So to do that, we devised three bywords, or I suppose I did, with brilliant members of staff who are still friends, such as Peter Windsor, legendary writer, Tom Clarkson, great writer, now superb podcaster, Darren Heath, brilliant photographer, and so on. Others who I should mention, but I probably haven't got time to go through more, and you'd get bored. But anyway, we discovered that we were going to make every single thing in the magazine, if possible, would tick the following three boxes. It had to have style, it had to have access, and it had to have authority. So style, it had to read well, it had to be premium, it had to look good, it had to be beautifully graphic designed. Access, absolutely key. We had to bring the reader to a place that watching Murray Walker would not bring them. Yes, they'd already seen Murray Walker commentate on Michael Schumacher winning yet another Grand Prix, so we had to take them behind the scenes. Whether that was, you know, these are actual stories, whether that was Fernando Alonso, a little bit later now, early 21st century, and Mike Gascoigne taking their Renault Formula One car to Concord and comparing and photographing the two together, whether that be snowboarding with Max Mosley, I kid you not, whether that be climbing Everest, not actually all of it, but we perhaps drew a veil over some of that detail with Alex Fertz. All of those things. So bringing the reader to a place that they had never been and never seen in terms of not only Formula One drivers, but actually, I think it would be fair to say, top-class sports stars of any kind.
Yeah.
And that was successful. And the sponsors absolutely loved it. And of course, there was, as I say, there was no website, no social media, and none of that. So every time Vodafone or Shell or whoever it was wanted to activate, they had to do so on the printed page or in television. Television would just show a fleeting glimpse of their logo. Our magazine enabled our readers to luxuriate in fascinating stories with style, access, and authority. Beautiful photographs displaying their logos. They loved it. And once the sponsors started loving it, they told the teams we love it. And that helped with the access. Because I would literally go to Ron Dennis at McLaren and say, I gather you've got only X amount of time with Mika Häkkinen at Monza. I gather he's doing a half-hour interview with Auto Sprint, Italian magazine. Just so you know, Ron, they have 50,000 readers in one language, Italian. We are in 34 languages, on sale in 110 countries, and about 3 million readers. By all means, choose Auto Sprint, but I'm going to be having coffee with the people from ExxonMobil and West and all your other sponsors later. So think on, Ron. Generally, they would change it and we'd end up with
it. Yeah, you can carry some nice power when you suddenly have that sort of access and content that people want to see in eyeballs, is effectively what it comes down to, doesn't it? So interesting and fascinating to hear the power and the grip you had over someone as powerful as Ron Dennis. And let's talk about Ron. So he became a bigger part of your life because in 2008, you ended up becoming director of communications at McLaren. So how did that opportunity come about? And you spent many of your years there. What was that whole experience like working with someone like Ron?
Well, yeah, I spent 10 years at McLaren. Ron and I, for some reason, because he liked the magazine, by the way, he likes things that look good. You know, Ron's attention to detail is one of the things he always boasts about, but actually it's attention to presentational detail. He wouldn't spot a split infinitive, but he'd what a wonky floor tile. Mm-hmm. So liked the magazine because it looked so good, because of Darren's photographs and because of the design. And, you know, he sometimes used to... jokingly commend us for your vocabulary, he used to say. Anyway, he offered me a job in 2001. He and I were having lunch at Manucor in his office in the then motorhome, old-style motorhome, of course. It wasn't the right job. It was a press officer. And in those days, a press officer, really, particularly at McLaren, because Ron didn't really like the whole idea of marketing and media. He liked commercial, he liked money, but he didn't really get journalism in that sense. So his press officers were usually enjoined to write a press release, print it out, and then walk around the press room handing it out. And occasionally, you know, having a lunch for journalists. That was it. It didn't rock my boat at all. I thought it was a bit dull, it was a bit anodyne. And why would he have paid me significant money to do that job? But we stayed in touch and we met often. We had lunches and we had dinners. Always, thank goodness, paid for by him, because he used to go a long way down the wine menu towards the bottom, I can tell you. And I don't know why we were chummy, but we were. We're so different in so many ways, different in more ways than you can imagine, really. And but nonetheless, we hit it off. And then in 2007, and of course, I interviewed him often, and he used to open up a bit to me, and it was good interviews. Then in 2007 was McLaren's Annus Horribilis, Spygate, and Ron was in the guano. You know, Mike Coughlan, the McLaren chief designer, had been found by the police, by the way, not by the FIA, by the police in the UK, to be in possession of 780 pages of Ferrari IP. It was an extraordinary scandal, an utter disaster for Ron. And he rang me. What can I do about this? Well, I said, I've got to report it, Ron. You know, I was then not only editor of F1 Racing, which by that time had become a completely international magazine in a gazillion languages, but also I was editorial director of the Motorsport Group, which encompassed Autosport, Autosport.com by then, Motorsport News, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, look, Ron, this is going to be a big story. This is going to be page one in all our magazines. It's going to be extensive. You know, you can't just take me to one side and ask for advice, because I'm going to be briefing our journalists immediately. So think on. I have to be honest with you about that. There's nothing that can really be off. Oh God! Oh no, Matt. I'm in trouble here. Anyway, the long and the short of it was the next Grand Prix was the Turkish Grand Prix, and he rang me on the Thursday and he said, "Could you come into my office?" By that time, the McLaren motorhome was called the Brand Center. That huge, still used, reflective, slightly scary building. Anyway, he said, come in. So I went up and he said, right, okay, I know I offered you a job before, but this time is real. You've got to come and work for me, you know, because I'm in trouble here. And he was, by the way, because Max Mosley had an extremely able director of communications, Richard Woods, who I had already been friendly with, and am now still. We had a bit of a hiatus in that friendship because of the professional impossibility of it being continued during the period I'm going to describe. But Richard wouldn't mind one describing him as a spin doctor. You know, he was an Alistair Campbell of Formula One, and Ron had never hired anyone with that kind of strategic bent. And, you know, if you've got Alistair Campbell on the one side and you've got people handing out press releases and offering coffees on the other, you know, it's not a fair fight. He finally realized that. He said, I need a strategic comms director. I need somebody who understands media, who understands journalists, who understands the Formula One landscape, who understands Max Mosley, Bernie Ecclestone, Ferrari, and, by the way, who understands what Richard Woods is playing at. And the funny thing was, out of the 7 billion people in the world at that time, that Ron knew and trusted, there was only one person who remotely ticked any of those boxes, and it was me. So I was very lucky. And we discussed the matter in Turkey, and then again at Monza, which is the next race, and then again at Spa, which was the next race after that. And then we agreed terms at Spa, and I was able to, well, leverage my good luck into significant pay rise. So that was another very, very, very good bit of luck for me.
Before we move on to what you're doing now, and W Series and your book and so on, the public perception of Ron Dennis, rightly or wrongly, is, as you say, a man who has a huge attention to detail, a bit of a taskmaster. It's his way or the highway. Was there another side to Ron that Joe Public doesn't know about?
Ron Dennis is a crazy genius. You know, and I wouldn't mind saying that in front of him, because it does describe both sides of him. But don't forget the genius side. He is a genius. But of course he's maddening, and of course he's eccentric. And all the stories about his fastidiousness are absolutely true. I once asked him, I said, well, is it true that you have your gravel laundered at home every 6 months? I have heard that. Is it true? And he said, no. No. Every 3 months.
I just knew that was coming.
Anyway, that is Ron. And there's thousands of stories like that I could tell you about him. But he, you know, but then you look at what McLaren was. Hmm. And magnum opus of that man who was born in a humble home in Woking, did a course in mechanical engineering at Guildford Tech, became a mechanic, and ended up, which he still is as we speak now, in terms of championship Formula One Grand Prix wins, the most successful team principal in history, and we are including Enzo Ferrari, Colin Chapman, Toto Wolff, etc. Ron is at the top of the tree. An astonishing achievement, not achieved by accident. Genius. Another side to Ron that people don't realise is, because he's shy, he often appears very austere. People find him off-putting, frightening even. Actually, he wants to be loved, which is actually a pity, because he's not very good at getting love. Mm. I don't mean people haven't loved him, you know, a wife, girlfriend, children, etc., etc. And indeed, people who work closely with him. Absolutely. And he's got a very good heart. But he hides all of that under a bushel. And people who don't know him find what I'm saying hard to believe. But if you ever get ill, my goodness, you're lucky if you work for Ron Dennis. Mm. Had an appalling back problem, a totally herniated slipped disc. I mean, I couldn't walk, couldn't sit up. Absolutely banjaxed. And Ron managed to get me in with the specialist, which he just did by, you know, haranguing him and threatening him. The guy said, you know, my surgery opens at 8 o'clock and I'm absolutely full for the next 3 months. And Ron said to him, my man will be in your surgery at 7:30. So you make sure you're there and awake for him, because he's coming in at 7:30. So you can see him half an hour before your others. And the guy did. This is a very, very, very senior neurosurgeon. And I was up and back at work on my feet within 3 days.
Wow.
So there was a good sense in it to Ron, but, you know, I would have been absolutely all out of ideas other than Ron basically doing what he does so well, which is browbeating people, whether it's a senior doctor to see my comms director, or it's Vodafone, you must open your checkbook yet again. Brilliant in that way.
He got the job done, I suppose. Spent an amazing decade with McLaren. And I'm curious to know, you know, of all the highs, of all the lows you had, I'm assuming you had to deal with the likes of, you know, Lewis Hamilton and Fernando Alonso, the pit lane incident in Hungary and their general demeanor towards each other. Later on, I suppose there was a few incidents with Jenson Button and Lewis Hamilton as well. You know, how do you look back at your time at McLaren and what some of the standout moments, the highs and the lows?
You know, I worked with three world champions, Lewis Hamilton, Jenson Button, Fernando Alonso, and all brilliant, obviously, in three different ways, or in many different ways, in fact. But for me, Lewis Hamilton, I mean, look, I always have said in my... there are three inseparably brilliant Formula One drivers of all time, which I would say Fangio, Clark and Senna. But I now think one has to add Lewis to that. You know, I think one has to add Lewis to that. And by the way, arithmetically, he has now, at 90 Grand Prix wins, won exactly the same as the cumulative total of those three greats.
It's unbelievable, isn't it? 24
and 41. I told you I was a nerd.
Good nerdy fact, that one.
Anyway, so the highlight of my career is clear to say, which is... being in the McLaren garage, and look, I can hardly talk about it without breaking up. I have to say, I find it so emotional to remember. But being in the McLaren garage, as Lewis passed Timo Glock on the last corner of the last lap of the last race of the season to become world champion, 40 seconds after... the race had been won by Felipe Massa, who was already celebrating in the cockpit and whose team were already celebrating in their garage. You couldn't write it. It was the most dramatic denouement that I've ever known of, certainly in Formula One and perhaps in many other sports as well. It's hard to talk about without welling up, I have to say.
Yeah, it's
an extraordinary...
It was an extraordinary thing to witness, and from a, you know, from a watching perspective, you know, you remember looking at it on the TV and seeing Massa and his family, and you know, jumping up and down, thinking, "Oh, we've done it!" And then that awful moment where they realise they haven't, and they go to despair, and to be at the heart of that must have been unbelievable.
Yeah, they go to despair, and then the last scene of that extraordinary little video is a Ferrari mechanic headbutting the monitor. If you notice,
no.
Look, I felt very sorry for him. Obviously, we were absolutely overjoyed, and don't forget, you know, the company McLaren had nearly died the year before because of Spygate. And we were 1 year later. Talk about redemption. Talk about redemption, not only winning the world championship, but doing so in that way against the old enemy, Ferrari. It was utterly, utterly amazing. But one of the things I'll always say is what a fantastic person Felipe Massa is. You know, he won the race in his hometown. He thought he was champion. He found out he wasn't. He stood on the podium, tears streaming down his face with his fist across his chest as the national anthem was played. But the day was all about Lewis. And he was a footnote to Lewis making history. But about an hour later, I was in the paddock. And you have to remember, the Interlagos paddock is incredibly congested, no room at all. And there were a million journalists, TV people, TV interviewers, all sorts, crowding around us as we were doing these interviews. And I was taking Lewis from here to there, from this crew to that crew to the other crew to this group of journalists, and so on and so forth. Suddenly, pushing through the crowd in red, this figure, little man, looked up, raised his hand. Lewis, congratulations, Felipe Massa.
Yeah.
That must have... That must have taken a lot.
Yeah, it's a classy move. It's a classy move, really classy move.
It's recognised it for what it was, I tell you.
Yeah, it's just nice to hear those sort of nice sportsmanship
stories. What memories to have.
Yeah.
The vivid imagery of that is just incredible. What an amazing stint in Formula One. And now we find you, of course, as we've already said, the day job is now working on the W Series, and you move towards that after Formula One. We've already had Catherine, of course, on the podcast. Are you enjoying it there at the moment? What's your take on the world of, what we've said on the podcast before is actually a lot of people dismissed the W Series to begin with. They didn't agree with the idea of having a women's only championship. And
themselves.
Yeah, we were just about to say, we chatted with Abby Eaton on the podcast, and I believe Alice Powell has said as well that, they didn't quite agree with the idea. But as it's gone on, and after an incredibly successful first season, being on Channel 4 as well in the UK, free to air, massive network, they realised what the goal of the championship is, I think, and that's almost for it to not exist in a way years down the line. How have you found the journey you've been on? Obviously, this year is a bit of a write-off, but still managing with the esports events. So to cut my long-winded question short, how is the W Series going and what's your view of the future of it?
Well, I went on the same journey. David Coulthard, who I'd known for years and years and years, rang me up and said, I'm doing this thing with Sean Wadsworth, who is now our chairman, and Catherine Bonmure, who you mentioned, is now our chief executive. And he said, are you interested in if I describe it to you? Because he knew I'd left McLaren, which I did do in the middle of 2017. And this conversation probably happened at the end of 2017. And I was setting myself up as a consultant or thinking about doing that. And so I said, well, tell me. And he explained. And I was sceptical for all the reasons you've just said. Then I met Sean, and then I met Catherine, both separately, and talked more with David Coulthard, and I began to get it. And I've now become not only, an employee, communications director, full-time, but also an absolute, evangelist for W Series. And people who criticise it because they say, why segregate, I think have missed a point, because that's my immediate reaction when I first heard about it as well. But what's happened so far? Look, the existing experiment has failed. Formula One has been in existence for 70 years, 70. It's always been open to men and women throughout that period. And yet throughout that period, there have only been two women, about 1,000 men, but two women who have actually started a championship Formula One Grand Prix, one of them 44 years ago and the other one 62 years ago. So it's not getting better, it's getting worse. And doing nothing didn't seem like a very proactive option. So what we've decided to do is create a series called W Series, performance positioned at the level Formula 3, when female drivers generally begin to fall off the ladder or hit the glass ceiling, whichever metaphor you prefer, because they generally get through karting and might touch Formula 4, but then usually daddy, not always daddy, but usually daddy says, right, that's it. I'm not going to spend any money more on you because I cannot believe that you are going to return the investment, because there has been no precedent for 44 years.
Yeah.
So whereas if it's his son, and I'm sorry to talk about daddy rather than mummy, but it is usually daddy. Mm-hmm. Whereas if it's his son, he can convince himself that little Johnny is going to be the next Lewis Hamilton and will soon be earning 20 million a year. Therefore, why on earth are we balking at this 300,000 or this 700,000? Obviously, I'm talking about rich daddies anyway. But when it's the daughter, there is no route. There is nothing to emulate. They say, if you can't see it, you can't be it. And daddy says, no, tell you what, love, I'll buy you a pony. And they stop racing. That is what we found happen. So we discovered that we would create something which would be the next step, performance positioned at the place where they normally fall off. and we created something. And by the way, because another big problem with international single-seater racing is that it costs an absolute fortune. So it is now the province of, I don't know, it's a billionaire boys' club.
Mm.
We decided we want to make it not a boys' club, but also not only for billionaires. So we pay not only all the costs of the racing, so they don't pay a penny piece. We also don't charge them any accident damage. Accident damage is a significant cost for young drivers usually. And we don't even charge them travel or accommodation. We pay for all of that. As a result of which, not only are our drivers female, but many of them are absolutely skint. You know, we have drivers who deliver pizzas for Deliveroo in their spare time to pay the rent. And yet, there they are on the podium at Brands Hatch or Hockenheim, free of charge for W Series. Yeah. And for me, that's something to be proud of.
Mm.
Not just because of diversity and inclusion, though of course that, but also because of a democratization of a sport that in many ways has become literally prohibitively expensive.
Yeah.
Mm.
One day, if one day one of our drivers, and I'm not saying it's one of the existing ones, it may or may not be. Some of them are obviously too old. For instance, one of our best drivers, Emma Kimmelainen.
She's great.
She's 31.
Yeah, she's a mum. Yeah.
Yeah, she's not going to race in Formula One. I'm not so silly as to think she will. But if one of them in the future does go forward into FIA Formula 3 and perhaps Formula 2, and perhaps, why not? Yes, let's say it, one day, Formula 1, which by that time may well be the first time a woman has sat and raced a Formula 1 car in a championship Formula 1 Grand Prix for what might well by then be half a century. What a fantastic thing to have been part of making happen.
100%.
I'm happy that day.
Absolutely. I mean, we're huge fans of the W Series. As I say, having watched it live, but also seen it on TV and been involved with one or two of the drivers, I'm interested to pick up on your point about one day, you know, will we have a Formula One world champion who's a female? Will we have a world endurance championship world champion who's a female? My take on it is I firmly believe that we will, but I think it'll be some time purely because of the life cycle of W Series. And it's so new that it needs that time to bed in and get more and more and more and more females into motorsport, get the bums on seats. And you are at some point going to find that Lewis Hamilton female equivalent or whatever, but it feels like it could be a few years. Is that fair? Or do you think that's too much of a harsh and simplistic view of it?
No, I think that's absolutely fair. You know, as I say, you know, some of our best drivers in W Series now are probably not going to be in Formula One because they are too old. And don't forget, Formula One has a youth fetish anyway. You know, Max Verstappen moved the goalposts in quite a way. You won't get another Damon Hill, you know, who arrives in Formula One in his 30s. Let's not forget. That won't happen again. So, no, I agree with you. If there is to be a female Formula One driver and a successful one, it is probably a little way away. But when she arrives, and I'm going to just paint a little picture for you. Imagine that you are sitting in front of your TV screen on a Sunday afternoon and you've had a lazy day and you turn on the telly and you hear the following broadcast on the news. Today, in Monte Carlo, Jenny Jenkins won the Monaco Grand Prix. Second was Max Verstappen. Third was Charles Leclerc. Now, that woman is suddenly going to be the biggest star in the world.
Yeah.
I think that's almost fair to say. The biggest star in the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
Certainly something we should be working for. And my goodness, this is also the pitch to sponsors, because W Series does have sponsors, does need more. And, you know, a W Series driver to go on that journey and end up in the place that I've just described you know, a great place for sponsors to help them on their way.
Yeah.
Journey.
That kind of thing sends goosebumps down me. It's imagine, wouldn't that just the scenes? You're right. Immediately, you're world famous. God, that wouldn't. It would just be incredible. And as you said, W Series is perfectly placed to start the groundwork for that. Let's move things forward a bit. Speaking about diversity and inclusivity, you're quite a pioneer for the LGBTQ plus community as well. And how is that landscape looking to you? There's been a lot of conversations happening, of course, over the last year, especially, of course, with Black Lives Matter coming into the foray, but should be there all the time. But how is that looking from your perspective as well? I listened to you on Jenny Gow's show the other week. It was fascinating to hear your thoughts on that as well. And we've had Charlie Martin on the show too. What's your take on it, or obviously coming from the world of Formula One when it wasn't quite so accepting?
Yeah, you know, I'm 57. I arrived in Formula One 30-odd years ago, 25 years ago. And, you know, I was the only gay in the Formula One village at that time. Well, that was out. Things have got a lot better for marketing people and PR people and journalists and people in those kind of professions in Formula One, where being gay is seen to be perfectly okay. But for a mechanic, not so much. And even in 2020, which is astonishing. And I know this because I speak to mechanics, because I'm a founder ambassador of Racing Pride, which was set up last year, 2019, in association with Stonewall, and seeks to do a lot of good work, I think, with junior drivers, male and female, well, LGBTQ+, in karting and so on. But I don't focus so much on that because of my Formula One background. I mostly focus on the mechanic issue, mechanics and engineers, because for some reason in those macho professions, it is not yet quite acceptable to be gay. Well, that is the fear of many of the mechanics who do not all come out and therefore live a lie and therefore work for 10, 15 or 20 years for McLaren or Williams or whoever it is and never introduce their partners to their colleagues and tell lies about why they aren't married and don't have children, or even tell lies saying they're not married when they are to someone of the same sex as themselves. That can't be right. And I also think that the teams have a part to play. You know, even 5 years ago, such a plea would fall on deaf ears, I'm sure. But now, just think a bit more inclusively about your language, teams. Don't ask mechanics, you know, how's your wife? How's your girlfriend? Don't immediately just phrase it in that way. Take the trouble to be a mensch in 2020 and say, how's your partner? Just in case you're talking to a gay man who is frightened of admitting it. Probably for no good reason, but because of vestigial feeling that I work in a white, male, heterosexual sport that will not accept me and will not accept diversity. Hasn't had any women for years, other than in menial jobs, or that's not fair to say, in associated jobs like PR and marketing. So not as chief mechanics, not, of course, as drivers. And it's dripping with money. So, yeah, it's a very privileged and rarefied area. And my work with Racing Pride, I'm very proud of. And they're brilliant people to work with. And, of course, I've introduced a couple of W Series drivers who are now also Racing Pride ambassadors, Abby Eaton and Sarah Moore, both of whom, of course, are lesbians, out and proud. And W Series, indeed, one of the pillars of W Series, one of our brand values, is to be absolutely welcoming and embracing of all difference, all diversity, whether that's LGBTQ+, or race, or anything else. The only thing is we won't allow men to drive for cars.
Yeah, no, that's a really
quite right, too.
That quite right. That's a really good message, and it certainly made, as you were talking there about, you know, the way you talk to people in the paddock, it made me think, because it's one of those subjects that until you sit down and consciously think about it, you do just naturally say, yeah, how's your wife? How's your husband? And we've talked a bit about the Black Lives Matter movement on this podcast with various people. We have Willie T. Ribbs and talked about racism in motorsport that exists today that's still horrific. And it made us think more deeply about the colour of someone's skin and what that means or doesn't mean. And I think this sort of conversation with someone like you about inclusion for other reasons, whether you're man, woman, transsexual, gay, lesbian, whatever, certainly does make me think about the way I talk to people, and we need to spread that message as far and wide as we can. So thank you for that. I think that was a really important little segment.
You're welcome.
Now, I want to move on to a few more quickfire questions. We could talk for hours. Let's kick off, though, with your book. You are now a novelist as well as everything else you've done. Tell us a bit.
There it is. The boy made the difference.
The boy did make the difference. Tell us about the book.
Shameless plug time, eh, guys?
Go for it.
Not at all. Firstly, congratulations as well for getting
thank
out.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Look, I loved writing as a journalist. Absolutely loved it, and missed it when I ended up working for Teams. Loved the Teams too, but and W Series and so on. But creative writing, yeah. And my mother was a novelist, and my grandmother was a novelist, and so it's in my blood in that way. And I suppose when my McLaren chapter came to an end, it, 2017, I didn't immediately throw myself back into normal paid work in motorsport because I thought, why rush? Why rush? Maybe you've got a chance. I was 54 then. I'm 57 now. I thought, maybe I've got a chance to write a book, and I thought I had a book in nothing to do with motorsport. And first of all proceeds from it will go to the charity that I set up in my mother's name when she died of cancer in 2013, the Bernadine Bishop Appeal, that obviously was her name, which fundraises for Click Sergeant, which is a charity that helps children and young people affected by cancer and their families. And when I say affected by, obviously that includes terminal cancer. So a magnificent charity that I've been fundraising for personally for quite some years. It was actually Eddie Jordan that got me into it, funny enough, about 15 years ago. But anyway, all proceeds go to the Bernadine Bishop Appeal, which fundraises for Click Sergeant. And the book is set between 1989 and 1991 in London, which is obviously where I was living at that time. And the narrative backdrop is the HIV/AIDS crisis of that time, which was absolutely devastating for gay men in particular. Obviously, it was devastating for everybody who knew them and families and LGBTQ plus people in general. Not that we knew of that phrase in those days. But gay men particularly were hit in the Western world by HIV/AIDS enormously badly. And, of course, AIDS is still a killer globally now, particularly in areas where the antiretroviral meds, which make it not a killer in the Western world, are not available, sub-Saharan Africa, so on and so forth. You know, but it was an enormously depressing and horrible time. And, of course, I personally lost a number of friends, and I worked as a home support volunteer or buddy in my spare time for a thing called London Lighthouse, which was at that time the biggest HIV/AIDS centre in the world, actually. And just helping people with AIDS in whatever way it might be. You know, I wasn't a medic, I wasn't a counsellor, but that isn't what your home support volunteer or buddy is supposed to be. It's helping you with things that no one else will help you with, which might be going round and running the Hoover round because you're too ill or too depressed. Or it might be taking you to the cinema because your black, brown, and purple and blue lesions as a result of the Kaposi's sarcoma on your face are so unsightly that you don't dare go alone without people yelling abuse at you. So you need somebody able-bodied to stand there and put a metaphorical arm around you and take you into the Odeon. Or it might even include holding your hand as you pass away. And now I've made this novel sound about the most depressing thing in the history of literature. It isn't. That is the narrative backdrop. And I wanted to tell that story because, thank goodness, AIDS is not the killer that it used to be in the Western world owing to antiretroviral meds. And so I found that younger people didn't really know quite what it was like, including younger gay men, like, for instance, my husband, Angel, who is 31, so significantly younger than me. And he knew about it in a historical sense, but he didn't know what it was really like. And I thought that was an interesting story to tell in a completely fictional way. But it's about a nuclear family, mum, dad, son. Not everybody in it is gay. There are heterosexuals in it as well. It is sad, but it's also funny, uplifting, and full of brave people. So that's The Boy Made the Difference. There you go.
Awesome. Well, we'll buy it. We'll drop a link in the description. Yeah, we'll make sure we point people in that direction. It sounds like a fascinating story. Now, listen, let's change tack slightly. Hidden talents. Have you got any?
Snooker.
Oh.
Snooker. Oh. Not a bad snooker player.
Good one.
Well, brilliant. Highest break, 63. But absolutely love snooker. Always did. Don't play nearly as much as I'd like now. And by the way, haven't had a 63 break for years. I get a lot of breaks of one now. Because I play so rarely. But I absolutely love snooker. And in fact, I wrote a series of blogs over a couple of years, quite recently, for another website. I won't mention a rival to you. But just for fun, for a mate, and very much enjoyed writing them. And, of course, going sometimes to the tournaments in order to interview players. Such a different world from Formula One.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you start off as a Formula One journalist, to get to the stage where you could interview Lewis Hamilton is either never or many, many years.
Mm.
Start writing a little blog on snooker. You can be interviewing Ronnie O'Sullivan within weeks.
Yeah. Incredible. Flip that on his head then. What are you bad at?
The worst dancer ever. The worst dancer ever. I make your average drunken dad dancer at a wedding look like Fred Astaire.
Is it like do your arms go nuts or is it just general weird body movements?
I can't do it. I was always good at sport. I was good at football. I can play snooker. I used to love cricket. I can do sport. I'll tell you what, it fills me. People dance beautifully, whatever kind of dancing, fills me with admiration, but also pathetic melancholy. Because I think, why can't I even do anything remotely, even close? Can't even enjoy myself in a dance.
Can't even do a simple box step. I always whack that out.
Oh, yeah.
Nice. Classic box step.
I'm not going to show you, that's for sure.
Thank God for Zoom. We've got last few questions for you before our final three.
Anyway, I should say, of course I can't show you because I'm sitting in my underpants, as everybody.
Aren't we all?
Always is.
Yeah.
Always is.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Why bother? You don't need to these days.
But what about socks? Are you gone with socks or not bothered with socks?
Ooh. No socks.
Yeah. Overrated. It's too hot for socks anyway.
Just the T-shirts. All you need saves on washing.
Yeah.
Now, before we get to our final three, which we ask all our guests, quick question for you. Zach Brown or Ron Dennis?
Nothing against Zach Brown, but it's got to be Ron Dennis. Obviously, I worked with him for 10 years and I worked with Zach Brown for 6 months. the McLaren team, I've got lots of great old mates there and I want them to enjoy the success that I enjoyed And, you know, good luck to them all. But no, for me, Ron Dennis, all-time great.
Yeah, good
nicely
stuff.
Nicely said.
We, as Harry mentioned, we have three final questions for you, which we ask of all of our guests, and they throw up various degrees and different types of answers. Number one, I shall kick off. What's got you excited at the moment?
I have to say, I know we've touched on it, but I have to say, you know, what's got me excited is the possibility, interrupted infuriatingly by obviously the tragedy of COVID-19. But what's got me excited is the possibility that we might actually manage to buck the trend, which has been trending for far too long, and have female racing drivers at a significantly high level. And yes, maybe Formula One, but also, you know, Formula Two, mm-hmm. International Formula Three, Le Mans at the highest level, IndyCar. One of our drivers in W Series, Jessica Hawkins, her ambition is not Formula One. She wants to be a British touring car driver. Well, if she was a successful British touring car driver, wouldn't that be fantastic? That has got me excited. I had, you know, I was skeptical, but I now firmly believe that it is a career ambition, for me certainly, to be part of a movement. And I don't just call W Series a sport or a series. I call it a movement and a mission to try to further the interests and make successful female racing drivers. And however that pans out, obviously we'd love to see a woman win the Monaco Grand Prix one day. But however it pans out, and that's probably a little while away, that has got me excited in answer to your question.
Mm, very good. If not doing what you've done and what you are currently doing, what would you be doing?
Well, before I found journalism and bucked into it, I will say I did all sorts of silly jobs, or not silly jobs, jobs that didn't pay very well and, you know, weren't what you traditionally call good jobs. You know, minicab driving, van driving, delivery driving. I worked on a jewellery store in a market, secondhand jewellery, betting shops, greyhound racing, all sorts. So if I'd been unlucky and never had any breaks, I'd probably be driving an Uber, except that I'm so appalling with IT that I probably would mistype the app or whatever they do. Yes, something like that is probably, if I'm not being, you know, on a worst case scenario, I probably would have, you know, kind of stumbled through my life and ended up doing something like that. The other answer to the question is novel writing, which is in my blood from my mother and my grandmother. And I have now at last dipped my toe in the water and published a novel. You know, if it's at all well received, don't forget all proceeds go to charity. So there's another big reason for me wanting it to be successful. But if it's at all well received, then yes, I might well want to try my hand at writing more novels.
Yeah.
If it's badly received, I'll curl up in the corner and lick my wounds and write nothing ever again.
Yeah. Yeah. So essentially, you would have been a very well-read Uber driver.
I'm sure they exist.
I'm sure they do. Final question for you before we let you get on with your day. What are you scared of?
Well, we've managed to get through however long it is without talking about politics, so I'm going to answer with four words. Donald Trump, Boris Johnson.
Well said.
That deserves a round of applause. And I think that's the perfect way to end our excellent chat with Matt Bishop. Thank you so, so much for joining us. We've talked about all sorts of different stuff. There's plenty there for everybody to get their teeth into. We'll have to do it again because there's still a load more that we haven't covered. But for now, Matt Bishop, thank you for joining us on the Motormouth Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Thank you so much for listening to the Motormouth Podcast. Do make sure you give us a follow on our socials, Twitter at Motormouth _, Instagram at Motormouth _official, and on Facebook, just search Motormouth. You can download the Motormouth app where you can get exclusive video content from MMTV, create your own social profile and interact with others, and check up on all the latest happenings with whatever motorsport takes your fancy. Don't forget to like, subscribe and review. And until next time, you've been listening to the Motormouth Podcast.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.